Throughout the vast expanse of Canada, these stories are not native folklore, but they are common to virtually every Indigenous family. Here is Melina Labucan Massimo.
My sister Bella was found dead 2 years and just under 9 months ago. It was probably one of the worst phone calls I've ever received in my life. She just actually graduated from college. She had left our community in the province of Alberta to move to Toronto to go to fashion school, and just graduated, and 3 months later she was found dead, and her case is still unsolved and listed as suspicious.
Since 1980, up to 4,000 Indigenous women in Canada have gone missing. Although Indigenous women only make up about 4% of the country's population, they account for 16% of all homicides, 11% of all missing people. This reality became a grisly crime story for Vancouver detective Lorimer Schenher.
We knew quite early on who the suspect was in this, who became Canada's largest serial killer. I had a tip the second day on the job, and I could not get the resources and the people in place to actually arrest this man. Or conduct an investigation in order to arrest him. And I think that that's the tragedy, because there's that overarching attitude that these women don't matter, these investigations don't matter.
Schenher told her story of discovery and change at an emotional panel discussion last month at the Women in the World Conference in New York City. Also there was Carolyn Bennett, who Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau appointed minister to lead a reconciliation project with Indigenous women.
The whole of our government is going to have to fix this. We know it's not going to be overnight, but we will launch a national public inquiry to get to these root causes. And we're going to put in place some of the things that we can do right now that the families have been talking about for a very long time. And it's time that we get on with it.
And with me now is Dawn Lavelle Harvard, president of the Native Women's Association of Canada, the association that first raised awareness of this problem that's now recognized at the United Nations.
Well, thank goodness the government has finally opened its eyes. Thank goodness they have finally admitted that this is a problem. It was beyond ridiculous. It was appalling to see how the government can look at lists, you know, 1,200 missing and murdered Indigenous women documented by their own national police force, well documented, and, you know, across the media, across the country from this report. And the Canadian government under Prime Minister Harper continued to say that this was not a problem. This was not a priority. This was not an issue. And that kind of attitude obviously contributed to the crisis when your own government is saying it's not happening despite what everybody is seeing around them. So to see the change in attitude is that first step, is that first ray of hope that things are going to change for our future generations, because that was the first step that was necessary, as it was the ignorance and the silence and the deliberate hiding of this crisis by the former government that was increasing the danger for our women. Because as long as people were saying, or that they were blaming the women, and that was one of the biggest problems with the former government, was this attitude that the women had high-risk lifestyles, that they were engaging in high-risk behaviors. And yes, many Indigenous women live in high-risk lifestyles, but it's not a lifestyle choice. It's because of poverty.
Can Carolyn Bennett, the Canadian minister who was appointed to deal with this reconciliation, really understand what goes on in the hearts of these women and families who have had this experience and who fear the future? Or is something like this suspiciously like the sort of colonial masters coming in and, you know, giving you guys Bibles?
Well, to the extent that she's not an Indigenous woman and has not grown up in a community in third world conditions, no, she could never really understand what it feels like to grow up in that kind of situation, what it feels like to live in that kind of situation and have the kind of hopelessness and despair that, I mean, we see the outcome with the extremely high rate of suicide. Our Indigenous young people in Canada have the highest rate of suicide in the world. We have heard at the UN that it's the highest rate in the world. So to that extent, no, she could never really understand what that feels like. But unlike most people, she has actually sat down with the families of the missing and murdered. She has sat with them while they cried their tears. She has experienced their pain. Unlike previous governments, unlike others who very often just simply turn away, I mean, she has gone and from coast to coast and spent day after day, week after week, experiencing that pain, So to the extent that anybody who has never lived it can understand it, I think she understands it better than most. But to a certain extent, no. Having never experienced that kind of despair and that kind of abject poverty, she couldn't really understand what that kind of hopelessness that would drive you to take your own life or that would drive you to desperate circumstances is like for somebody who lives in those kind of conditions.
What kind of awareness is going to be required by the nation at large in Canada to address this issue and to bring a kind of justice between groups that have lived side by side for more than a century?
Well, I think the Truth and Reconciliation Commission has been a pivotal turning point in the awareness of everybody else in the country, because the horrors of the deliberate abuse, the deliberate removal of children, it can no longer be seen in this country as, you know, a well-intentioned educational experiment that just went wrong. It is now a matter of public record, and the stories of the survivors of the residential school are now out there for people to understand that it was a deliberate act of aggression and violence against children and against our peoples. And people are now really understanding the horror of the residential school experience. And so there has been a greater awareness. They can no longer pretend that this was just well-intentioned and you people didn't try hard enough. That is the first step towards the larger population understanding how Indigenous people end up in the circumstances that they're in now, and they can get away from, you know, the blaming the victim attitudes and the old-fashioned bootstrapism. I mean, it's very hard to pull yourself up by your own bootstraps if you don't have boots, and you don't have boots because the colonizers have come in and taken everything you had, including your children. So that was the important turning point, was for people to understand that this wasn't just the outcome of Indigenous peoples being lazy and not making an effort. Our circumstances now are the outcome of a deliberate program of dispossessing, disempowering, and forcing Indigenous peoples into poverty and the removal of our children and abuse. That kind of truth has to come out before we can move forward together, because that's the understanding that the Canadian population needs in order to have any kind of future moving forward. Because as Indigenous peoples, it becomes impossible to have a positive relationship with the larger society when you're constantly being blamed for your own victimization.
Dawn Laval-Harbert is president of the Native Women's Association of Canada. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.